Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Veglund, and here's one way to put your cash to good use.
In each case, my money was pooled with that of other people.
That's Nicholas Kristof with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Kristof got sweet returns from a small investment. What's his idea?
In each case, my money was pooled with that of other people.
So here's a quiz. According to Kristof, are we talking A, lottery tickets? One way of getting that winning number is by lumping your bet with others. Or perhaps it's B, shared investing. It's a new strategy that lets you buy into pricey blue chip stocks. Or is it C, microloans? A way you can lend a small amount of money to someone who really needs it. No clue? No problem. The answer's up next on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
There are lots of ways to improve your credit score. Pay your bills on time. Don't close your credit cards, even if you aren't using them. Get yourself listed as an authorized user on someone else's card. Oh, that last one? Yeah, that's going away. I'm Tess Veglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me someone with a better credit score than I have so I can just borrow some good credit. Lenders are worried about a growing number of people who've discovered a fast way to improve their credit ranking. Just become an authorized user on a stranger's credit card account. But you'll pay big bucks to the middlemen who offer to make that match. And how about the question of whether this is legal, much less ethical? We asked Marketplace's Bob Moon to find out the real score.
I'm thinking of a number between 450 and 850. Do you know what it is?
It's been hard to miss commercials like this one lately. Credit bureaus have been making a lot of money selling us everything they know about us.
It's my credit score, and it happens to be 720. The higher my credit score, the better chance I have of saving a lot of money.
It's true, those with the best scores can qualify for much cheaper rates on a mortgage, auto financing, even insurance, and that has given rise to a whole different kind of cottage industry that's been making a lot of money manipulating those credit scores. In exchange for fees of hundreds and even thousands of dollars, these middlemen promise to match you up with a stranger who will, in effect, rent you their good credit. Now the credit industry is moving to close the loophole, and personal finance author Liz Pulliam-Weston says that's an unfortunate development for many who never intended to abuse the system.
It's kind of a sad thing because this technique, which we call piggybacking, has been something parents could use to help their kids get started with credit, a spouse could use to help the other spouse get over a credit glitch. And basically what it involved was the person with the better credit would add the other person to their credit card as an authorized user. So their good history with this credit card would be imported to the other person's credit file.
Michigan real estate broker Ralph Roberts added his teenage daughter to one of his accounts a while back to see how it worked.
A couple months later, we checked her credit, and she now had 19 years of credit history, and she wasn't even 19 years of age yet.
And she hadn't even had her own credit card. Roberts says that's not fair, that everyone should be responsible for their own credit history, not borrowing somebody else's. He says abuse of the trick has exploded.
It's really widespread. I was on the internet doing some research on this, and there's new sites popping up daily offering these services. This is like one of the cancers of home ownership. You shouldn't be able to enhance your score to entice a lender to give you a loan.
Tom Quinn is an executive with the credit scoring company Fair Isaac, the name behind the formula for so-called FICO scores. That's the industry standard for ranking your likelihood of paying your bills. He told us authorized user credit card histories will no longer be considered in the next generation of FICO scoring due to be rolled out starting this September.
Our early research shows that approximately 75% of the consumers with a credit report history will see no impact with this change.
which means one out of every four could see their FICO scores change. And Liz Pulliam Weston, the author of Your Credit Score, says many might be in for a rude surprise.
If you've been added as an authorized user to someone's account and this information suddenly disappears from your file, if your scores aren't already high to begin with, you could see a fairly sizable drop in your credit score because of that.
It's at least possible that some credit card lenders could seek to boost rates for those card holders. It could be a year before the changes are fully implemented, and in the meantime, Weston fears some consumers might be tempted to try goosing their scores.
I would just be very careful with this, because I think now that it's been publicized, you're going to see a lot of companies coming out of the woodwork promising to do this, and what they'll actually do is just take your money and run.
The Federal Trade Commission has said it's investigating the practice. Authorities in at least two states, Nevada and New Hampshire, are already calling it fraud. Chicago Sun-Times personal finance columnist Terry Savage thinks anyone who's engaged in the practice is playing with fire.
I will be surprised if some enterprising U.S. attorney doesn't bring up a test case. I would suggest that they might all be implicated if some U.S. attorney decides to consider this bank fraud. It's certainly a risk not worth taking.
Savage says it's also not fair to all the others who do play by the rules. In the end, she says, we all pay. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
Well, we just heard how people struggle to raise their FICO scores. A good score can save thousands on a loan, and it can also affect other things, like what you pay for insurance. This week, the Supreme Court issued a ruling on credit scores and how insurance companies can use them. To help us sort through the legalese, we turn to Bob Hunter. He's with the Consumer Federation of America. Bob, welcome to Marketplace Money.
Glad to be here.
Now, I think most consumers are aware at this point that their credit scores are used by everyone from mortgage companies to insurance companies to potential employers. What was this original lawsuit about?
Well, it was about what consumers have to be told in terms of whether or not their own company has charging them more because of their credit score than they would have if they didn't use credit scores.
And what did the Supreme Court say?
The Supreme Court basically let the insurance companies off the hook, at least more off the hook than they were before in terms of disclosing how credit scores are adversely impacting you.
And what specifically did the court say in terms of what insurance companies have to tell you and what they don't?
Well, the Ninth Circuit had ruled that every time you were charged anything higher than the lowest possible rate because of credit scoring, you had to be told that you were had an adverse action and that therefore you could act on it. Now the court has said, no, you don't have to disclose that. It only has to be where an insurance company decides that they really have in some way adversely impacted the person with the rate. So it's much vaguer now as to what is required of an insurance company. And I think it's a loophole that many insurance companies will not disclose much.
So in essence, the insurance companies have absolute freedom to use your credit score to determine your rate. And the only reason that they would have to tell you about it is if it's the only determining factor. If it's part of a bunch of factors that they're using to determine your score, they don't have to mention it to you.
Yeah, it's a much softer test. So the insurance companies, since they use a lot of different things, will probably not have to tell you that credit scoring is hurting you.
Presumably, I guess, if you're told that your score is affecting your rate, you could shop around, for instance.
Well, there's two things you can do. One is shop around, and second, and probably equally important, is you can make sure that your credit score is right. We found with our study of about 500,000 credit scores that there's huge error rates. So I think you want to have the ability to ask which credit score was used and go test it and make sure it's accurate.
Do you think that this ruling means that more insurance companies could use credit scores to determine insurance rates, that might become more prevalent and indeed harder for consumers themselves to spot?
I think it's already pretty well hidden. Consumer groups can't get at the data underlying the credit scores. We've challenged the data on certain grounds, such as redlining type grounds where low-income and minority people might be adversely impacted, and consumers can't get even at their own data. They can get at their own credit score information, though, and I think they should.
So is that the biggest piece of advice, that you should be asking your insurance company whether they used your credit score and which credit score they used?
Yes, you should ask that, and you also should be aware that there are still some companies that don't use credit scores, and so if you are really being adversely impacted, you should consider shopping around as well.
Bob Hunter is the Director of Insurance at the Consumer Federation of America. Thanks for helping us sort this out.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You've heard us say it many times on this program. It's practically a mantra for our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Go for index funds. They are the easiest and often most cost-effective way to keep a portfolio in balance. In theory, your index fund mirrors the performance of, say, the S&P 500. But what if you could eke out an extra percentage point or two beyond how the index performs? That's the goal of something called enhanced index funds. And here to tell us more is Rob Hennessy of SmartMoney.com. Rob, what is the difference?
Well, you figure a regular index fund tries to track the performance of an index. Most of them try to track the S&P 500. And they make up, you know, really a lot of what we invest in, say, 401ks and things like that. You always want to do what the broader indexes do. What enhanced index funds do is they try to do a little better.
And from what I gather, the whole point of this is to do just as well as the index fund itself, which you really wouldn't do if you factor in the fees, if you just took the regular index fund. So the enhanced funds supposedly make up for that difference.
Right. And the argument's always been, you know, you're paying investment managers to essentially come in with a tie with a main index. You've never paid an investment manager in these index funds to beat it before. And so in order to make up for the fees that kind of get eaten from your account just by doing what the broader indexes are doing, these guys try to make up that difference by getting you more performance. The problem is a lot of the offerings that are out there now have high fees. Also, there's no guarantee that they're going to beat the index. In fact, some of the bigger of these funds underperformed the index. So when you look at it that way, you're paying more to do worse than an index fund. Now, a lot of the managers say it's still very early. We still have to kind of get a comfort level. And they say ultimately it'll even out and we'll do better. But, you know, the performance so far has been sort of middling.
So is this something that investors should maybe wait and see if they perform the way they should or not?
Absolutely. And if you want an index fund because you want the safety of just performing the way everything else is doing, then go that route. If you want to be aggressive, pick a fund that maybe doesn't track an index. Pick a fund with, you know, a track record that historically has beaten the broader averages, and then you're getting that enhancement. With the enhanced index funds, there's really no track record to go through. And anytime you buy a mutual fund, you want to see how past performance is and what their philosophy is. There's really not a lot of that past performance yet. So they're definitely a product to be wary of.
All right. Ray Hennessy is an editor at SmartMoney.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Foreclosures, bad for the person losing a home, but could they be a good deal for you? Chris weighs the pros and cons in the mailbag. And we dig up a new way to grow veggies.
We have a fifth of an acre lot. So I'm trying to make a distinction that we are basically micro farmers or maximum extreme gardener.
We profile a day in the work life of an urban gardener. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Summer on the farm, the lazy buzzing of bees, the clink of ice cubes in a glass of lemonade, and of course, the clamor of car horns, shoppers, and public buses. At least that's what it's like when your farm's located in the city of Pasadena, California. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we visit with a new kind of farmer. He started an agribusiness in his own backyard, literally.
What we have here is we have ground cover strawberries, so we can, you know, get those luscious strawberries. We have leftover kale from the winter, and we're transitioning here from broccoli that we had, and we're going to replace it with peppers.
My name is Jules Derves. I'm 59 years old, and my primary job is that of a gardener. I guess why I call myself a gardener versus calling myself a farmer is that I'm trying to separate myself from people that have the notion that we have fields and that we have equipment and that I'm out there, you know, working the acreage that doesn't exist on this in the city. We have a fifth of an acre lot. So I'm trying to make a distinction that we are basically micro farmers or maximum extreme gardener because we have maxed out this place with all the fruits and vegetables we grow. We sell first to the restaurants and caterers. It's like they have a sort of a standing order every week. And then whatever is left over, we offer to the general public. We have so much orders that we don't even need to go to a farmer's market. We have several restaurants that will take anything we have. Our problem is not having enough, not having the fields. I'm sure that they would want more if we could give it. What I like about this job is the sense of fulfillment that it gives me. And I feel empowered that I'm able to grow my own food, and I feel independent. I'm not tied to somebody else providing me with what I needed for life. Oh, yes, well, there's one thing I definitely dislike is the insecurity that this job brings. I have to learn that I'm not in charge here. Every time I feel like I'm in charge, something happens that let me know that, hey, you know, you're just a student here. You're not the big boss. It's nature that makes the call. Whatever happens, you have to live with. This last year, we were doing great guns on our harvest. We were very proud of going up and up and up and getting, you know, bigger harvest. And last year was the worst year ever. We lost 90% of our tomato crop. That was kind of scary because that was our cash crop. And we lost, we only had 10% of the normal. That was insecure. And we're waiting on this year. And if it doesn't happen this year, then I'm really going to be insecure. But I'll have to find something to do about it. Yeah. At the beginning, it's like any kind of new venture. You're going to lose money, I think they say, for at least the first 3 years. We're getting a little bit of profit now. I would say we could make under $20,000 here. That's going to be a funny number. They're going to think that's low, but we provide food for ourselves. We don't have many expenses. We don't have a food bill. We provide our own energy with solar panels. Our utility bill is practically nothing. So the 20, if we had that all every year, that could go a long way because we don't spend much. I want to do this till the end of my days. I want to be actively planting and growing things till the last. We think urban farms are great because they're small, and they're necessary because there's a lot of land here in the city that's unused. And boy, if you look around how bleak some of the cities are, you can use a farm here and there.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by April Lunston.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
A financial zoo brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, bull-bear ratio. The bull-bear ratio is a weekly indicator that gets info from Wall Street insiders. Ratio analysts poll financial advisors to see what they're telling their clients. Bull, if advisors think the market's on an upswing. Bear, if it's on a downturn. This week, the bull-bear ratio fell for the third straight time. Some experts say the ratio is a good judge of what the average investor might do. More bad news leads to selling, and that means other investors might follow, which means that there's another animal on the loose. Bah!
Got a box full of letters. Thinking my life.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and the gentleman seated to my virtual right is our own financial whiz, Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
And a virtual hello to you, too.
All right, you ready to answer some burning questions?
Oh, you know, Tess, I love burning questions.
All right. Well, before we get to them, please do take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button, or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. And Jay is on the line from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hi, Jay.
Hi.
So I understand you're facing a major career change. Tell us about that.
That's correct. I've been working for the same company for 31 years, and we are about to be purchased by a current competitor.
Hmm.
And in that process, it is very likely that I'm going to be squeezed out.
And when might this happen?
It's going to be July 1st.
This is happening very soon then.
Correct. We've known about it for some time, but it's now actually happening.
So what's the situation for you?
Well, I'm 60 years old, and I'd always planned to retire at 62, but this is a situation where I'm highly compensated, and I'm presuming that I'm unlikely to find a position within the next couple of years with a comparable pay. So I'm considering whether or not I should take a lower-paying job and potentially hurt my ultimate Social Security benefit.
Hmm. Do you have a severance package coming?
There is a severance package, yes.
And do you think that you could last those 2 years until retirement through severance and whatever savings you have?
Absolutely.
Well, Chris, is it a good idea to take a job?
I think it would be a good idea to take a job. The way the Social Security calculation goes is it looks at your entire earnings history, and then it adjusts it for inflation, and it chooses the 35 best years.
Oh, so it's not the most recent years.
No, that is, you know where that, I think where that comes from, if you look at it, a lot of the old-fashioned, what we call defined benefit pension plan, the pension plan you work for so many years, and then you get a payout based on how long you've been at the company. Typically, those are based on, depending on the plan, the last 2 to 5 years. But for Social Security, it's your 35 best years adjusted for inflation and then indexed. So they come up with a monthly average figure. You can go to the Social Security website, and they have an online calculator. It's very good. The one thing you get from the Social Security Administration, your earnings history, your sort of benefits history they give you.
Right. I get that every year.
Right. You have to fill that information in on the online calculator because it's not linked to the Social Security computers and your earnings history for privacy and security reasons. But you can, you know, you can plug in the numbers and you can see what your benefit is going to be.
Okay. Well, good information about Social Security payments, Chris. Does that help you out, Jay?
It certainly does.
Terrific. Well, best of luck and enjoy your retirement.
Well, I'll have to put it off another couple of years now.
Yeah. Well, then I should say good luck with finding your next job.
I thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And let's hit the email bag. We've got Matt writing in from Turner's Falls, Massachusetts, and he wants to know our thoughts on something called target date mutual funds.
I like target date mutual funds.
Okay, well, there you go. I think we're done.
There you go. Okay.
let's do a little explaining for everybody. He's 28, and he wants to get a little more proactive about his retirement savings, but doesn't want to become an expert in the stock market. In fact, he doesn't even want to try to become a hobbyist. So let's start, first of all, with the definition of target date mutual funds.
All right, let's keep it real simple. A target date mutual fund is a very conservative strategy for saving for your retirement. So you start the fund with a very clear idea of the age you'd like to retire. That's key. And then the types of investments you're comfortable with. And as you get closer to your retirement date, the fund goes away from the riskier investments and towards more safe or conservative investments.
Okay, so these are the kinds of funds where you say, I'm just going to leave it alone. I'm not going to bother about rebalancing it every year or anything like that.
Exactly. Does all that automatically for you? There's a couple things to be aware of, however. You don't have to become a stock market expert, but you still have to look a little bit. What's the fees? What's the diversification? Are you comfortable with what investments are being made, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But you don't have to become an expert on the market, but you are going to have to do some homework.
Is this what we refer to when we talk about a lazy portfolio?
Yeah, it's a lazy portfolio. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with being lazy about the portfolio. This is a portfolio for people who, you know, work a lot and they're involved in their community and maybe they're all their family or their friends. And, you know, they like reading novels, not prospectuses. I mean, if that's you, these are the kinds of portfolios you should seriously consider.
All right. Well, if you want that warm and fuzzy feeling that having your finances in order gives you, we can help. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org, or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Let's go to the phones again. Emily is on the line from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
Wonderful.
And what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I am a homeowner. My husband and I own a home in Uptown, which is a portion of Minneapolis that's pretty prominent. And with no formal experience in real estate myself, I'm wondering if my husband has a good idea or not.
Okay, and what's his idea?
There's a house down the street from us that is in foreclosure, and he would like to purchase it with the intent of renovating and placing it back on the market.
What's it listed for?
It is actually listed for $275,000, and typically homes in our area run right around $500,000 to $600,000.
And does it look like it's a fixer-upper, or just move in and you're all set?
Definitely a lot of work to be done.
Okay. So you would be putting some money in for renovations?
Yeah. We're gauging about at least $100,000.
And how would you be purchasing the house?
We would probably have to use the equity that exists in our home.
Okay. Well, Chris, this is a question that's coming up more and more often as
yep.
foreclosures go up. People are interested in possibly getting those properties at a bargain rate. What's your thought about this?
I want to toss in one other question. Now, if I was buying this home, this fixer-upper, considering the damage that I can do with a hammer and a saw, I'd put you in bankruptcy in a fairly short period of time.
So don't hire Chris as a contractor.
How about your husband?
My husband actually is a professional in the field.
That's absolutely fascinating, because that's where the edge comes in. Obviously, he knows how to use a planer and all those things. I'm sort of making up these terms. I've walked through a hardware store once or twice. I really have. He can do that. So this is even more than sweat equity. He has a lot of knowledge. So in the area that you're talking about, Uptown, most people around the country aren't going to know where Uptown is, but it's a very nice section of Minneapolis, and it's kind of hip. And so obviously I hang out there a lot, too.
I don't know. I haven't seen you around much lately.
So in that sense, I really think that you do have an edge. So my questions would be, one is purchasing the property in foreclosure, making sure that you get as much knowledge as you can, that there aren't any hidden liens that might cause a problem. So there, your husband, if he doesn't have that kind of knowledge, he may want to hook up with a lawyer or at least get some advice from a lawyer, so that what he's doing is getting a property free and clear. And then he's going to add the human capital knowledge. The other side of the question is, you are taking a risk on the debt side.
Right.
At a time when the market is slow. And I'm in the camp that does not think that the housing market is going to collapse, but I don't see the housing market turning around anytime soon. What if it just takes longer? You end up owning this property longer. What's the downside? Run the numbers on the downside. This is a business. You're no longer a homeowner. You are now in a business. What could go wrong, and how able are you to withstand that downside? It's a risk-reward question.
Right. And the question from my standpoint is, while my husband is an expert in his field, he's not an expert in the finance area, and I'm not either.
Right. And so that would make me nervous. The other question I would raise, just as, you know, we're sort of thinking about this, you know, is there someone who could come in as a partner that you trust that might be able to spread some of the financial risk? The other thing would be, okay, maybe this is not the right move. Maybe this is a little bit too much risk, but maybe this is an area to start investing in. So maybe this is the one you're going to walk away from. But if your husband is willing to do this type of thing, you know, maybe start off a little smaller, learn what are the trade-offs, how does this really work? And over a period of time, thinking about this as an additional business, an additional cash flow that you're going to gain some expertise in. But because it's a partnership, I have a feeling you both need to be comfortable with it.
It sounds like that's true. And we had actually considered a partnership. And so that's nice to hear that that's the recommendation as well, possibly.
Okay. Well, does that help out?
Yes. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thanks for the question.
All righty.
Take care. Well, even with all the negative headlines going on about real estate these days, people are still willing to risk their fortunes on it. If you're on the fence, give us a call. We'll try to make it clear and simple. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, one more reach into the email bag. Chris Shilish wrote in from Cincinnati, Ohio, and he got a call from a company about a year ago that claimed to have found assets worth about $3,000 based on his old address. Well, the address wasn't 100% accurate. It was pretty close, so he contacted the treasurer of the state that he used to live in, but couldn't get any sort of answer. The company says for a 30% fee, they'll recover the assets for Shilish. He knows it sounds like a scam, and it certainly does, but is there another way to find lost assets if they're really out there?
I got the simple, simple way to do this. You go to unclaimed.org. This is a government website, and it will have a link and information to a link to Missing Money, missingmoney.org, which is where you're actually going to do your search. You don't need to pay anybody to do this. You can do it yourself. It's very simple. You'll get all the information you need, and don't pay somebody else to do a search.
And is that a national database of unclaimed assets?
It is. What it is that is the database of all the people in the various states that are in charge of unclaimed assets. They don't actually own missing money, but that is approved by them. And so they will send you to Missing Money. And then as an individual, you click on individual assets and then you do a search. And it really is the best way that I know to go about finding out whether or not you have some lost assets out there.
What about these things that you get in the mail or an email where they contact you and say that they've found the property? Is there any reason why you would actually work with these companies? Or is it purely a scam?
I have no idea if it's a scam. I think it's, you know, I don't think it's a good use of your money. I don't see why you would do it. I have no ability, frankly, to judge whether or not this is a legitimate company or not a legitimate company. But what I do have and what I've just given is a legitimate avenue to find these lost assets. That's the route I would go. Where you do start paying more money is when you get into a different world where there may be among wealthy people, there's search for certain assets and you're hiring out some real skilled forensic accountants to find things. But when you're just getting something in the mail or an email, my assumption always is this is not a good deal.
All right. Well, Shilish, we wish you luck and hope that you find that $3,000 that is owed to you. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but please do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY, or visit our contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Chris, thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
You don't need big bucks to make a big difference. Imagine changing the finances of one family with only $25.
In each case, my money was pooled with that of other people. And he had used that to buy supplies in bulk so that he didn't have to go every day to the market.
We tour the world of microcredit and find out how you can be a microbanker. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. One of the most common questions we get here is, what can I do with my money to make a difference? The obvious choice is charitable giving of both your money and your time. But now there's another choice, microfinancing. Normally, microfinancing happens on a larger scale. Banks and other financial outfits lend small amounts of money to people who are too poor to get a traditional loan, usually in the developing world. But several organizations, like Kiva.org, now allow you to become a microlender. You go on a website, pick what project you want to finance, and in 6 months or a year, you get your money back. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof recently wrote about some loans that he's made, so we invited him to talk about the experience.
Well, this kind of fit into a few things that I've been interested in. One is microcredit, which I've seen in a lot of countries and I'm incredibly impressed by. And the other is connecting donors directly with projects at a very local level. And frankly, also, I always get asked by people, you know, so what can I do? so partly out of kind of impatience at that, I thought, well, I'll give them an example and I'll take it for a test drive. And so I made small loans to a few people on Kiva. And then later when I went to Afghanistan, where I had lent to two people, I thought I'd pay those people a visit.
Tell us a little bit about that visit and who you met and what kind of enterprise you were funding at that point.
Sure. Well, I had lent $25 each to two people, Abdul Sattar, who's a baker, and Abdul Sabur, who runs a little electronic shop. So I show up in this, you know, poor neighborhood in Kabul, and the baker, Abdul Sattar, I mean, he didn't know what the internet was. He'd never been on a computer. And, you know, all of a sudden I show up and I explain I'm his banker. But he took it in stride, and he understood that he was getting these loans from foreigners through some kind of newfangled way. So he then bribed me with like a dozen loaves of bread that he just baked. And boy, they were good. That was my credit analysis.
Well, so what had your $25 done for him? Because certainly we as Americans thinking about $25, it's hard to imagine that would go very far.
Sure. In each case, my money was pooled with that of other people.
What was the total that had been given to or loaned to Mr. Sattar?
I think it was about $425. And he had used that to buy supplies in bulk so that he didn't have to go every day to the market, and also to open up another bakery. Mm-hmm. The other person that I'd lent to, this fellow running an electronics shop, it was even more striking, the gain that he'd had, because, you know, before, when he didn't have any working capital, he had to go every day to the marketplace to buy spare parts to fix televisions. And by getting a little bit of working capital, he would make one trip every 2 weeks or one trip a month. And with that inventory, he was able to use his time to repair TVs instead of to travel, and to spend much less money on transportation.
How does this kind of very personal microfinancing work? From the time that you make a donation or make a loan — I keep calling it a donation, it's really a loan.
No, I mean, it really is a loan. And that really is part of the idea, that you're teaching people business practices, that you're cultivating entrepreneurs rather than just beneficiaries.
So how does it actually work?
It depends on which microcredit group you're talking about. Uh-huh. Kiva does not have any employees in Afghanistan, for example, but they work with a local group in Afghanistan called Ariana Financial Services, which is run by this just incredibly dynamic young woman. Kiva supplies the lenders, and she supplies the borrowers.
Now, this is not a typical loan where you get interest.
Right now, they're not. Actually, Kiva is exploring the possibility, even later this year, of being allowed to pay, you know, modest rates of interest.
So what's the benefit to you of doing this?
A couple of different things. I mean, it is a way of feeling like you're making a difference, of doing so in a way that encourages economic activity, which ultimately will provide more employment, mm-hmm, to support the economy. I also think that there's really a benefit, though, of just engaging with the rest of the world and of seeing who you are helping. And, you know, in this case, I happen to lend to two men, but that is actually unusual in microcredit. Usually the borrowers are women, and one central purpose of microcredit has been to raise the status of women in the developing world.
As people, as consumers, as our listeners are deciding how to allocate their charitable giving, how is this kind of effort different from, say, just giving a charity donation to an aid group? Because, for example, there is no tax deduction here.
I think most people, in the case of Kiva, essentially roll over their loans. When one is paid back, then they roll it over to somebody else. And look, there are a million incredibly important potential recipients for donations. You know, I believe passionately in Darfur, mm-hmm, malaria, you know, but I think that especially for somebody who wants, you know, visibility, and they kind of want to know directly who does their money go to and what does that person look like, Kiva is, or that whole approach, is one useful addition to the portfolio.
Nicholas Kristof is a columnist for The New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us and for really shedding some light on a very interesting way to spread your money around the world.
Thank you. And I think your listeners would actually have a lot of fun spreading their money around in this way.
Well, let's consider that a challenge. Thanks again.
Take care.
If you'd like more information on becoming a microlender, we have a link to Kiva and other similar organizations on our website. Nick mentioned that most of these microloans go to women in an effort to boost their status in the developing world. We arranged to speak with one of those women. Carmen Rueda Palcar is a widow and mother of three. She lives in Guayaquil, Ecuador, where she runs a small convenience store. Carmen has received two loans from Kiva.
I needed the money because I wanted to invest in a small store that I have right outside of my house. I bought inventory for the store, and then I also started raising chickens. Also, I invested in making plantain chips here for the local community. I bought a small machine to make plantain chips, and I've been doing that also.
Carmen asked for and received $500 for her store, called Tienda Rosarito. The money came from six different people from Australia, Alaska, Missouri, and Kansas. Now, $500 wouldn't even pay for the permit to open a small business in the U.S. We asked what it did for her.
Actually, $500 was perfect for me because I ended up paying less interest, and it was exactly what I needed to raise an inventory for my store because I do have a small store.
And what was she making on this day?
My living room right now is serving also as a small restaurant during lunchtime. I started selling lunches recently, so my living room is kind of turning into another small business. I'm making minestrone soup with a little bit of pork in it, and I have rice with beet salad and fried meats.
Save some for us. We have a link to Carmen's loan request, which she's now paid back in full, plus a photo of Carmen and her kids in front of their store on our website, marketplace.org. Some 5,000 miles from Carmen's store in Ecuador, women in the West African nation of Mali are getting help from another microfinancing program. This one doesn't rely on individual lenders. Instead, it's led by a large organization. But it's much tougher to hand out loans in societies where women have very little power, including over money. Matthew Algio reports on efforts to change that ancient and some would say unfair tradition.
A bank cashier carefully counts her till in a small Malian village near the Burkina Faso border. It's a scene typical of any bank, but this is not a typical bank. It's one of 11 so-called microbanks scattered across Mali and operated by the international charity World Vision. The banks make low-interest loans as small as $10. Borrowers can use the money to invest in anything from goats to grain. Charles Koulibaly runs the program. He says nearly all the loans are made to women.
World Vision, dans ses différentes interventions, vise premièrement le bien-être des enfants.
World Vision's primary focus is the well-being of children. If we really want to take care of children, we have to do it through the mothers. When women have an opportunity to gain money, the first thing they think of is their family and their children.
World Vision has had to overcome cultural barriers in each of the 40 countries where it runs micro-lending programs. But in Mali, those barriers are especially high. Malian society is patriarchal, and that's putting it mildly. Polygamy is legal, and by law, only a man can be chef de famille, the head of a household. So, Charles Koulibaly explains, the women who borrow money from World Vision have to promise to keep it for their own use and not give it to their husbands.
Il y a souvent des problèmes dans les couples.
We do have a problem sometimes in marriages because of this system. Because many of the men think more of their own needs when the money comes in. As a result, it sometimes affects the couple's relationship.
About 2 years ago, Veronique Yara borrowed $100 from World Vision to buy some 50-pound bags of peanuts, which she resold to her neighbors. With more loans, Yara expanded her business to include beans, rice, and a grain called millet. Now she's branching out into pigs and chickens, which roam free outside her tiny mud brick home. Yara says her business ventures help support an extended family of 15, including 9 children.
Without this money, we wouldn't be able to live. The children wouldn't be able to go to school. With this money, we can meet all our expenses. The money has solved many problems.
The money has also helped Yara open a shop for her husband to run. The store is about as big as a garden shed with a dirt floor and just three shelves lining the back wall. It sells staples like sugar and flour, as well as treats like penny candy. Amos Yara admits he had some reservations about his wife's business ventures at first, but now his doubts have vanished, and Amos says he doesn't mind letting his wife manage the family's finances.
Before she got the money, I had nothing to do. Now I have this shop, and we are planning to build a new house.
World Vision's micro-lending program in Mali has succeeded even beyond the charity's expectations. Last year, more than 8,000 women borrowed an average of $111 each, and 95% of those loans were paid off. The program has helped women come a long way in Mali, but they still have a long way to go. For example, a wife is still not legally entitled to her husband's property when he dies. Women's groups are currently lobbying the Malian government to change that law. In Bamako, Mali, I'm Matthew Algio for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at NASDFoundation.org.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, as you are well aware, the Shanghai Stock Market Index plunged 8% this past Monday.
Oh, yeah, I am well aware of that.
And, you know, at that time, you told me it was a pretty big deal. Now, really? It seemed to me the market bounced back the next day. Now, there's kind of a deja vu feel to this.
I had a feeling this was coming.
Uh-huh. Back in February, when the market fell sharply as well, you said that was a big deal.
I believe I actually said it's the epicenter of risk in the global economy.
That's exactly what you said, yes. But then, too, the market bounced back into record territory.
You're right. But there is no question that China's stock market is overheated. It has nearly doubled in the past year alone. And it's all domestic, too, since the market is essentially closed to foreigners. It looks like a bubble to me. So here's a straight story. I don't know the timing, but bubbles eventually pop.
So why does it keep bouncing back?
You know, one of the problems with bubbles is even when we know that it's going on, it's very difficult to get the timing. What's going to be the event that changes investors' minds? I mean, think about the U.S. real estate market.
Yeah, we heard for, you know, a couple of years that that bubble was going to pop.
Absolutely. And Robert Shiller wrote that book, Irrational Exuberance. He reissued it, came out, talked about the real estate market, and it kept going. So now you have the Chinese market, and you have all this cash, remember, 40% savings rate, and you have a new middle class, and they're thinking, hey, I can go in the stock market and I can speculate, I can have put money in, I can take money out, and maybe I too can be rich. I don't know how long it's going to go on, but I am confident that it will burst.
All right. Well, if the market does go pop, as you say, how worried should the rest of us be?
I would be worried. I'm in the camp that believes China is incredibly important to the world economy. The reason why I think it will have an impact is not because it's going to expose weakness in the Chinese economy. It's going to expose weakness in the Chinese financial system. And if you have investors all of a sudden realizing that the greater fool theory no longer works, that you can't find a fool to sell an overpriced security to, except for you're now the fool, and then they start panicking, and then you rip asunder this sort of gentleman's agreement that we're not going to look too closely at the Chinese financial system,
That's why I think it's a real concern.
Well, and that's certainly not kind of what we've been hearing about the Chinese economy, which is that it's been booming and that they're buying up all the world's oil and all the world's steel and copper and that things are going great gangbusters there.
Right. And all that is true. China has joined the world economic system at an incredible pace. When the bubble bursts, a lot of Chinese investors are going to lose money.
Well, you talk about Chinese investors. What about investors here in the U.S. who, you know, I think a lot of people have gotten into international funds because of what they've seen going on in China and, of course, other parts of the world, India among them. But, you know, it's really prompted a lot of people to say, hey, you know, let me put my money somewhere where I'm seeing huge returns for a lot of other people. Should we be backing off of that at this point?
If your investment and you've been investing in Asia as part of a diversified portfolio, you know, I would stay. If you've been sort of on the sidelines and now all of a sudden you go, you know, I got to get on Asia. This has been doing really, really well. And I just don't think the U.S. is going to do that well. I got to get into this market. I got to find me some mutual funds.
Yeah.
I got to find me an ETF.
Yeah.
I would say, hey, forget it. Slow down.
Well, you just popped our bubble.
Exactly. Because then what you're doing is you're putting yourself at enormous financial risk. So short term, I would be extremely concerned. But as part of a long-term diversified portfolio, I think for most people, exposure to the Asian economy is extremely important, recognizing that there are going to be some wild rides on that roller coaster.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, we're always happy to take a wild ride with you.
Thanks a lot, Des.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, a new installment of Educating Rico, in which our hero unlearns a word.
Dude, did you see the fight behind the library? Ron Strzelecki got totally kicked in the escrow.
Hey, that's not what escrow means. Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes, with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. See you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
American Public Media.